look, it's going to be very difficult for you to build a practice from scratch without having, you know, referral sources and relationships coming out of the blocks. And the way to do that is to go into an office suite and to either follow someone, one or more people in the suite from court to court, take referrals from them of matters that they don't want to do themselves, assist them, again, in exchange for reduced or free rent. And over time, you develop the confidence and the experience where you can untether yourself and be able to do things, you know, do the work with both what I call competence and confidence.
Did you ever feel like what you learned in law school didn't prepare you for the world of running a law practice? Law school didn't teach us how to start our practices the right way so that we could scale them into a thriving business. We didn't learn how to make sure that our businesses would meet our financial goals and provide the type of lifestyle we deserve. After 10 years, I was fed up with struggling in my practice and decided to begin a journey to scaling a successful practice that would actually allow me to finally live the life I've always dreamed of. I invite you to listen in on the conversations I'm having with some of the most successful solo and small firm practitioners, along with leading business entrepreneurs, and share how I am implementing what I am learning, all with the goal of helping you take control of your practice and your life. This is The Law Entrepreneur. Hey there, fellow law entrepreneurs. Welcome to episode 25. I'm your host, Neil Tyra. And today we have as my guest, Alan Fanger. Alan is a civil litigator based just outside of Boston, Massachusetts, who has been in practice as a sole practitioner since 1990. So he's an experienced solo and has, as you'll hear, migrated his practice from a general solo practice to one that's kind of niched down to a more specific series of civil litigation areas. In addition to that, Alan also has created some really interesting products here for use by law firms in the preparation of their clients for such things as mediation and depositions and trial. So the kinds of things that a civil litigator would need to prepare their clients for. So without further ado, let's listen to Alan Fanger. Alan Fanger, welcome to The Law Entrepreneur.
Hey, Neil, it's great to be here with you.
Terrific. Thanks for taking the time. Listen, tell our audience a little bit about who you are and how you got to be where you are.
Sure. I am a sole practitioner. My office is in Newton, Massachusetts, which is a nearby suburb to Boston. I've been on my own since 1990. I attended University of Michigan undergrad, got my bachelor's in 1981. I then spent a couple of years in the newspaper business, both on the reporting and the editing side. Then went to law school at Boston University and got my JD in 1986. Spent a couple of years in big law at a large firm called Pettit & Martin in San Francisco. I felt the tug of the East Coast, even though I absolutely loved San Francisco, and who wouldn't? And then moved back here to Boston in 1988, worked for a small firm, and then in 1990 went out on my own. So I've been on my own, like I said, since 1990. My practice evolved. I initially did a tremendous amount of public defender work under contract with the Commonwealth of Massachusetts in the district courts, representing defendants who were charged with misdemeanors. And I built my practice up for several years while having that component of my practice as more or less the foundation. And then I had a general practice for a long time, I would say until about the mid-1990s, perhaps even the late 1990s, when I evolved into a litigation specialist. And since the late 1990s, I've done exclusively civil litigation and now focusing really on just a few areas, those being probate litigation, real estate litigation, homeowner contractor disputes, and a little bit of plaintiff side employment work. And anything else I do, I would probably do kicking and screaming because I was dragged into it by an existing client.
Exactly. And we're going to get around to talking about your transition or your ongoing transition from attorney to entrepreneur. But let's just go back to your roots a little bit for a little while. So you relocated back from San Francisco back into to the East Coast. Tell us a little bit about contract work for the public defender's office, because I think that's probably an avenue that a lot of new law school grads or new people transitioning into the solo practice might want to take advantage of in order to build up their litigation skills.
Sure. I had heard about the opportunity to do public defender work under contract from a colleague who was actively doing it. And at the time, I lived in Brookline, Massachusetts, which is an even further inner suburb to Boston. So what I decided to do was to look into doing public defender work. And I ended up doing it both in the Brookline District Court and the Newton District Court. And what that involved was, and what it continues to entail, is you have what's called a duty day. And on that duty day, you are at the court and you are the attorney. There may be others, but in Brookline and Newton, more often than not, I was the only one to be assigned to represent indigent defendants who were brought into the court either by arrest or summons to answer charges in criminal cases. And so from the outset, you would either be involved in representing the client at arraignment, and then from arraignment all the way through the conclusion of the case, or at the beginning, it would be an arraignment plus perhaps a bail hearing if the district attorney wanted bail imposed for the defendant. So that resulted in my more or less cutting my teeth and being able to try a lot of cases, learn about the rules of evidence, be comfortable trying cases in front of juries and judges, understanding a whole lot about criminal procedure, everything from bail to motions to suppress to motions in limine to probation violations, how to read a criminal record. And I did that for probably about 4 or 5 years. The way the compensation worked is that you were compensated, back then it was a paltry $35 an hour for in-court work and $25 an hour for out-of-court work. But if you got multiple cases in a day, you could do multiple billing on those cases. The unfortunate thing is that Newton and Brookline then and now are not extraordinarily busy criminal courts. So there were days when I would be there from perhaps 9 in the morning to 4 in the afternoon when the court closed and wouldn't receive an assignment, in which case you would get what's called duty pay. And I think that amounted to about $150 an hour for the day.
Yeah.
And of course, that was before the internet, before smartphones, before email. So you'd basically be mired in that court for the whole day, sitting around, perhaps trying to do some paperwork. But there were really no laptops. There was nothing to allow you to work efficiently. And I dreaded those no case days because they were big time losers. Fortunately, I didn't have a wife or a family to support at the time, so the financial burdens fell on me alone. But I have to say, it was a great experience. But I was happy to be done with it.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think you know everybody's jurisdiction is going to be slightly different. I know in our jurisdiction, we have a pretty busy criminal docket, both at district court and circuit court level. And I know people who do contract work for the public defender's office for different reasons, some for the more complex, more serious cases that young public defenders are not quite ready to handle yet. And in other cases, other situations, they have a special capability. For instance, perhaps they speak foreign language fluently and can do contract work for the public defenders. Explain a little bit just how you were mentored in that situation, how you were taught the ropes. Was it a combination of, you know, throwing you over the side of the life raft, or did you actually have some hand holding?
Well, it was actually a combination of both. You're right on about that. There was a training seminar that I had to attend. I think it was either a 1 or 2 full day seminar that you had to take that as a condition of taking on the work. But like anything in our profession, Neil, so much of your competency and your confidence and your approach has to be self-taught. And there's nothing that substitutes for actually getting in there and being involved in all aspects of the case, knowing how to do an arraignment, knowing how to argue bail, knowing how to read a criminal record and be able to make arguments on behalf of your client who might have defaulted on appearances 15 times, but somehow has magically cured the defaultitis that he or she has previously suffered. Being able to argue a motion to suppress, determining what evidence to put in a trial. And those things just get acquired over time by experience. So it turned out to be both. And like everything, and you know this as well, we're constantly learning. So I could have done that for another 25 years, and I'd still be picking up new things every day.
I think that's a hurdle that a lot of potential solos have to get over, that the terror of really not knowing what you don't know, and particularly true if you're going to be in a courtroom. And I had a attorney mentor who told me that the best solution to that is just go sit in the courtroom. Take a day and sit in the courtroom and just watch. And I likened it to learning how to play golf. If you're fearful of learning how to play golf, just go sit on the first tee and watch everybody tee off. And then you realize, look, it can't be that hard.
I've been playing 43 years and it's still hard.
Yeah.
but I think you're so right about the concept of mentorship and its importance in the arc of anyone's career in our profession. When I first started practicing, I practiced in an office suite where I did some work for another attorney in the suite in exchange for free rent. And I followed him around from courthouse to courthouse. Now, he didn't do criminal defense work. He did civil work.
So this is when you moved into your small firm practice?
Correct.
After you left the public defender's contract work?
While I was doing contract work.
Oh, okay.
And trying to build up a private practice to supplement and eventually overtake it. But I can't emphasize enough the importance for young solos, perhaps even fresh out of law school, to try to develop one or more mentorship relationships. Now, we're all pressed for time. I know being in practice for 30 years, my time is of such precious quantity. But I think that the one way to develop mentoring relationships and to do it in a way that's mutually beneficial is to understand that, look, it's going to be very difficult for you to build a practice from scratch without having referral sources and relationships coming out of the blocks. And the way to do that is to go into an office suite and to either follow someone, one or more people in the suite from court to court, take referrals from them of matters that they don't want to do themselves, assist them, again, in exchange for reduced or free rent. And over time, you develop the confidence and the experience where you can untether yourself and be able to do things and do the work with both what I call competence and confidence.
Yeah, and it has to be a two-way street, because you're not going to get a mentor unless you have something to offer that mentor in return. And there's quite a lot of ways to solve that issue, as you suggested. You can do work in exchange, assist, provide some free paralegal support, anything to learn the ropes.
That's exactly right. And what happened early in my career as a solo is I ended up taking on a lot of collection work. And I happened to be in office space with a guy who couldn't be bothered to do collections on matters that were involving maybe $10,000 or less. So he actually gave those to me to do. I would periodically duck into his office and ask questions of him as to, you know, how do I do this? How do I do that? He was helpful. And then I worked those cases as if they involved $10 million and not $10,000. And I ended up getting good results for the clients. I read a lot. I filled in the blanks by reading CLE books and doing whatever I could to acquire the knowledge to be able to handle the matter competently. So, you know, starting out, solos should be taking on matters that are of that kind of low risk. I happen to think that, for instance, commercial collections, not retail collections, because that involves potential exposure to Fair Debt Collection Practices Act liability, but commercial collections really are about the lowest risk kind of work that you can take early in your career. And that's what I did, thankfully. And that really sort of gave me the launching pad to ascend to more or less greater heights in the profession.
And then you started more or less a general practice. Now, is that because you were taking in cases, or as my friend Nakia Gray said, food law, anything to put food on the plate? Or was it a conscious decision to broaden your practice areas?
It was definitely a food issue, Neil. Absolutely, positively. I went on my own in 1990. 5 years later, we had our first child. And necessity being the mother of invention, I continued to broaden and have a very general practice, you know, well into the 90s. Simply because I had to pay the bills. We had formula, diapers, you know, all the things that you that become line items in the budget only after, you know, you have this great miracle of birth, and you realize you not only need, you know, time and tender loving care, but also the income to be able to afford to have a family under your roof. So that is. That's the way it evolved. And there was a point when I did so many different things. I was doing commercial collections, personal injury, workers' compensation. I was doing bankruptcy. I was doing divorce. I was doing some minor wills and trusts, and I was doing some probate matters. And I was stretched way too thin from a competency standpoint. And now I've come full circle. Now, and you use that really pointed, appropriate phrase, you know, you don't know what you don't know. But what I find myself doing now is drawing my zone of competency very clearly so that I'm not only narrow-casted in terms of my area of practice, but I'm also very careful not to spread myself any further than I either think I ought to go or that I want to go.
And one of the, I think, benefits from now drawing that circle in a little tighter is that you then have cases that you're not willing to accept that you can then refer out to other attorneys and create relationships in that way.
Absolutely. And I do that frequently. And I've been the beneficiary of a lot of inbound traffic over the last, I would say, 6 or 7 years from pretty robust online marketing. And so what I've been able to do is to leverage that online marketing capability to generate more work than I actually want to take. I mean, to be sure, my online marketing efforts are designed to bring in only the work I want to do. But in the process of developing an online marketing campaign, you can't be perfect. So you end up getting inquiries that are outside of your target area. And so where things have been on the periphery or well outside the area, I refer them out. And sometimes I ask for a referral fee. Sometimes I don't. It depends on the type of matter. For instance, a personal injury case, I would typically ask for a referral fee. but I do get a lot of referrals for estate planning work. And I don't ask for referral fees when I refer those out because I have relationships with a number of estate planners who reciprocally refer me probate litigation. So there's no need for a referral fee in that instance.
There's a quid pro quo kind of arrangement.
Absolutely.
Well, that's a great segue into talking about your current marketing methods for attracting those ideal clients that you've now narrowed your practice down to. So talk to us a little bit about what you mean when you say a robust online marketing campaign.
Sure. So I was really fortunate back in around 2009 to connect with a guy in my area named Ian Bardorf, who is considered one of the area's top online legal marketing experts. And I put in Ian's hands the job of developing an effective online marketing campaign. And what that involved was a combination of Google AdWords, search terms in search engine optimization. It involved a social media presence, but also involved the extensive use of blogs. I'm a big blogger. I have a number of blog entries on my site, and I also have a blog that covers law, both law and politics, as well as sports. It's a separate sports law blog called On Further Review that I just recently started. And what I did back then is I blogged frequently, and we posted the blogs to my LinkedIn page and to Facebook, and that was before Instagram, so we couldn't put any photos up. There was no Instagram back then. And that resulted in a real high volume of online traffic. Now, if we look at the period from, say, 2009 to about 2012 or early 2013, I was getting upwards of, at some point, 2 inquiries a day through search. And as a result, I could have probably run my practice without getting what I call brick and mortar referrals from any lawyers at all.
Sure.
Could have done it strictly based on online traffic. So that was a real boon to my practice. And it allowed me to focus even more specifically on the areas that I really want to practice in: probate litigation, real estate litigation, homeowner contract disputes. And over time, that's how it's evolved, or over the last 7 years, that's how it's evolved.
So you said you put Ian Bardorf in charge of this process. You hired him. He's a vendor, is that correct?
Exactly.
And are you still with him, or have you transitioned into managing that process on your own?
No, I actually use a guy named Jeff Lance now, because Jeff has it works on both my website and my marketing. I loved Ian and loved working with him, and continue to recommend people to him. But I wanted to find somebody who could both enhance my web presence and really work extensively on the design of my site. And so Jeff does both. He is constantly revamping my site, but he's also overseeing the web marketing.
So, and then do you still contribute a lot of the content?
I do. And in fact, I continue to blog, perhaps not as frequently as I should, but I also have direct input on the Google AdWords campaign. And I think that's a pretty good skill for anyone among us to master, because as much as you can find really good online marketing people to do your campaign, in the end, it's not a lot of time to design it. And only you know how you practice. And if as a solo, you understand how people search for you and what they're looking for and the search terms that they use, then if you were to put, I would say, 4 to 6 hours into structuring a Google AdWords campaign, it would be time well worth investing. And since I've been involved in personally designing that campaign, my online traffic has increased substantially. I would say that's been over the last year.
I think with Google AdWords, you know, there's a lot of pluses and you know, a few minuses is normally the case with anything. But if, as you say, if you are directly involved with doing the research to understand what search terms are appropriate for your firm, it forces you to think, well, what is my firm all about? It helps you narrow and actually define what it is that you're trying to do. And that exercise alone is beneficial.
Very much so. Now, one would argue that, well, this is why you hire online marketing people. And I understand that argument, but if you're designing a Google AdWords campaign, you are not taking complete control of your online marketing. For instance, I have no idea as to how to manipulate what are called backlinks or how to leverage the content of a blog to take advantage of organic search. And I don't want to be involved in that part of the business. But because I understand how my clients think, and nobody understands how my clients think better than I, and because I know from being in the trenches of my areas of practice what the operative terms of art are and how prospective clients would approach hiring someone like me for one of my areas of practice, then I think that I have knowledge that's superior to anybody I could hire that I could parlay into an effective campaign.
Right. So now let's probably in connection with your online presence, you've also embarked on a side business, if you will. It dovetails nicely with your law firm, creating some important video content. Why don't you talk to our listeners a little bit about that?
Sure. Let me just give you a background as to how I got into this side business. I, over the years, have encountered any number of instances in which, in representing a client at a deposition, I have became increasingly more frustrated at my client's inability to follow my instructions that I'd very clearly given them prior to sitting at the deposition. I mean, I would come out from so many depositions, Neil, and I would be saying to myself, I can't believe that my client testified that way. I mean, I had spent a couple of hours making very clear what the instructions were and what they should and should not do. And I gave them this handout that it was from what was then the American Trial Lawyers Association, now AAJ, giving pointers as to what to do and not to do. And they completely ignored all my instructions. Like I just, and in many instances, these deposition testimony failures materially affected the case. They, in some instances, resulted in summary judgment. In other instances, they affected the settlement value of the case. And so I decided to do a sort of deeper dive and try to come up with some solution that would help not only me, but my colleagues. And what I came up with was the idea of a streaming deposition preparation video product that a client could access from any device at any time. And so I ended up originating a script. I didn't do any market research. I just said, I think this is a good product and I'm going to develop it. So I wrote the script over several months, and it was a script for a video that really covered the basics of deposition preparation and answering techniques at a 30,000 foot level. And I ended up hiring a production team, and we shot the video on three separate days. We had to shoot some of it in a courtroom because I wanted to show the impact of inconsistency between deposition testimony and trial testimony. And we shot most of it in a conference room using a bunch of different actors who we had cast through a casting agency. And then we had post-production, and that video was completed about a year ago. I then had an idea for doing a video on mediation. And the reason that I came to that idea is that I had been involved in any number of mediations over the years where I got the impression that the client really didn't understand what the mediation process was going in, and that it really might be of benefit to both my clients and my colleagues' clients if clients generally could have the curtain drawn open and could see in advance of a mediation what the mediation might look like and how it might evolve, or how things might evolve during a mediation session. So I did, and by the way, going back to the deposition video, I did do market research after we had the first cut of the video. And based on the market research, I ended up doing some reshooting. With the mediation video, did the same thing, did an initial shoot of the video, was actually all done in one day, believe it or not. Great production team. And then we did post-production work and again, a market research. And the mediation video takes a fictitious but a realistic case involving a dog bite. And you start with a plenary session involving a mediator who happens to be a retired judge sitting with the parties and counsel. You have the opening statements by each side's counsel. And then you follow the mediator from the private session, one private session to another over the course of this fictional day that starts at 10 o'clock and ends fictitiously at 6 o'clock with the case finally being settled. And you actually see in the last scene the settlement documents being circulated among parties and counsel at the table. And we address all sorts of issues in the mediation video, such as management of expectations, a two-number strategy relative to the first number you come into either prior to or at the mediation, and then the sort of bottom line figure, adjusting that bottom line, using the mediator as a messenger, using the mediator as a repository for confidential information, giving the mediator ownership of ideas and proposals, and generally managing expectations and disappointment. And just going back for a minute to the deposition video, in the deposition video, we talk about everything from how to keep your answers short, how to be consistent with your written discovery responses, how to deal with issues of privilege, how to deal with answering after objections to form by your counsel. We talk about what's on and off the record, the roles of everyone at the deposition, how to handle documents, and a whole bunch of other things. And we intersperse it with graphical reminders, as we do in the mediation video. And then I'm in the process of writing the script, and we're going to be going into production in the fall on a trial preparation video, which will do really two things. It will be a primer for clients on how to testify at trial, both in direct exam and on cross-exam. And it will also, again, pull open the curtain for clients on all these components of the trial process, which can really only be understood if you see them depicted on video. And that includes opening statement, the closing statement, how you pick a jury, how you do voir dire, either panel voir dire or individual attorney voir dire. What happens? What are the jury instructions? How does the jury reach a verdict? What's a verdict slip? What are how are objections handled? What about these sidebar conversations? What's on the record? What's off the record? How do you deal with documents? How do you present yourself as a witness, looking confident, body language, dress, all that stuff? Because I think we just shroud too many things in mystery in our profession, particularly when it comes to litigation. The analogy I often use, Neil, is that if you were going in for surgery, let's say you were going to have a stent put in, okay? You had a heart problem, you're going to have a stent put in. You have a pre-op meeting with your surgeon and the anesthesiologist, and they tell you pretty much what's going to happen when you're in the operating room. Okay, so we're going to hook you up with an IV, we're going to make you a little bit sleepy, and then eventually we're going to pump you full of general anesthesia. You won't know anything that's happening, but while you're asleep, we're going to poke and prod you this way and that way, and you're going to get up after about 6 hours, and you're going to feel very sleepy. You might have a headache. We're going to give you pain medication. We're going to have you here for probably 2 days. And if everything's okay, we're going to discharge you. You're going to be on pain meds. You're going to be able to do this. You're not going to be able to do that. We don't do enough of that when it comes to litigation. We have clients who have these extraordinarily stressful events, deposition, mediation, trial. And so often we soft pedal the stress and we don't give clients the full picture of what's going to happen, literally and figuratively.
Well, so, as I had mentioned to you in our pre-interview, I think this just is really a brilliant tool on a number of different levels. And I want to just touch base on them for a moment. I know you have developed these products for the purposes of educating the client, but I'm going to suggest that it is just as important as an educational tool for the attorney as well, particularly if they're new to a litigation practice or inexperienced. This is an invaluable teaching aid for them.
Very much so, Neil. And we've actually gotten receptivity for the products from all sorts of areas of both the profession and legal education where the teachability of the videos is seen as being something valuable. So, for instance, right, we start with law schools. We've got law schools that have purchased or are subscribing to the videos. We have a number of potential strategic partners who are interested in selling these as part of the packages for data and case management that are provided to firms. And we also have some interest from firms in using these videos as part of either associate training programs or summer associate training programs. Yeah. So yes.
I can see it as a learning tool for the attorney as well as the client. And then for a solo practitioner or a small firm, this is an invaluable tool in terms of being able to maximize your time and improve your productivity because, as you know, if you're a litigator, you go through that same mediation prep or deposition prep or, coming up soon, trial preparation prep. You go through it over and over and over again with each new client, and it's not an efficient use of attorney time to do so when you can make this video available, and therefore the client gets the benefit of that expertise while you're able to devote that time to something else.
That's correct. And the mantra that I was giving when I was first selling this, and I continue to give this, you know, freely to anyone who will listen, is that we're not in the business of substituting for preparation. Rather, I see the products as a supplementary tool, a reinforcing tool. And let's say that you had budgeted, or you budget 2 hours for deposition preparation. And let's say that you normally would spend the first 45 minutes to an hour discussing the trappings of the deposition and the basics.
The logistics.
The logistics. But let's say that you could have the client watch the deposition video, say, twice before the client comes into your office. And let's say that you could dispense with that aspect of the preparation, knowing that the client has actually watched the video twice. So instead of spending the 45 minutes to an hour on the infrastructural aspects of the depo, you could actually spend 2 hours in substantive preparation, dealing with anticipated lines of questioning and moot courting the witness so that you can work, actually do a substantial dry run through. And look, we all know that's not going to bulletproof the client bad performance of the deposition. The way I look at it, you're trying to limit the harm that the client can do to him or herself at the deposition.
Right.
And it harkens back to a theory that a very famous scholar named Edgar Dale. I hate to say his affiliation because I went to Michigan, but he's actually a professor at Ohio State.
Ooh, that must be tough
for
you to.
I know. I'm a little wobbly when I say that, but Edgar Dale postulated this theory, and nobody's ever tried to refute it. But his theory was that we remember 20% of what we hear, 30% of what we see, and 70% of what we see and hear. So using, you know, that theory, you know, albeit one established by someone at a school that really should not be named, I feel like exposure to the video and the audio and the verbal all at once is something that, you know, we should all try to take advantage of that, because we all need to understand that preparation and demystification, both of those components, are so essential to practicing responsibly.
Yep. Well, Alan, this has been fantastic. One of these days, you and I are going to have to get together and trade deposition horror stories, because every attorney has several of those. But in the meantime, tell our listeners how they can reach you, where your website's at, how they can take a look at these products that you offer, and how they can generally take advantage of all that you have to offer.
Sure. On the practice side, my web address is lawfang, LAWFlankANG.com. My email address is alan@lawfang.com. And then on the business side, the web address is empowerlegal.net. And my email address for the business is Alan, again, A-L-A-N, at empoweredlegal.net. And on the website, you can either subscribe to the videos, you can subscribe to individual videos or both of them, and then three of them as of probably about October, or you can just buy them outright. We offer both subscription and purchase options, and you know, have an e-commerce site so you can pay by way of credit card.
And as I mentioned to you privately, I mean, I think you're positioned perfectly with these products. So I wish you great success. I know I'm going to be a client very soon here of the products. So again, Alan, thanks ever so much for taking the time to be with us today on The Law Entrepreneur. And we'll catch up a little further down the road.
Hey, Neil, it's been a pleasure. Take good care.
All right. Thank you. Well, there you have it, fellow law entrepreneurs. Thank you for listening and being a part of today's program. The utmost compliment you could pay me is to go over to iTunes, subscribe to the podcast, and leave a strong 5-star review if you think the podcast and what we're trying to do here is worthwhile. Feel free to share the link to the podcast with your friends, family, and coworkers. I would be very appreciative if you did. So until next time, thanks again for listening to The Law Entrepreneur.